Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NabTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. I occasionally talk on this podcast and more often in the general press about what NabTrade investors have been buying and selling. I find myself talking about Afterpay a lot. The tech sector in Australia is very much in its infancy, really, but we have some incredible success stories in Atlassian, which is listed in the US, to the disappointment of some of our investors, and Canva, which is not listed but is getting a lot of attention at the moment. Many of our investors, though, are really looking for that next mega hit, and tech seems to be the most exciting sector in which to seek that out, with the Wax Group, I don't even know how to make that A sound long enough, Wax Group, a perennial source of questions from our investors. Today, I thought I'd go to one of the most prolific commentators on specific stocks in Australia. He's extremely well-regarded and fabulously frank with his views. I'm talking with Scott Phillips of The Motley Fool to get his views on these stocks and whether or not you should find a place for them in your portfolio. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Gemma, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Scott, we'll start with something terribly important. Mm-hmm. How do you do your research? You provide stock-specific research, yep. Which our investors are obsessed with.
Yes, which is good.
Yes. How do you do that research?
Yeah, so it's a combination of we're bottom-up investors as a general rule, which mm-hmm. means that we don't look for big macro trends, big major things going on. We try and find company-specific opportunities. And so there can be great companies in bad industries or bad companies in great industries. It's important for us to start with the company, not necessarily top-down. Now, that being said, the opportunity itself can come from anywhere along that continuum. So the starting point for any research can be as simple as literally reading the paper. And it sounds almost a bit like I'm advocating responsibility, right? Anyone can read the paper. But in terms of finding the next idea, what you're looking for is the germ of an idea that helps you look further into a particular topic or industry or company to see what's there. So anything from reading the paper through the conversations through to literally just paying attention to what people are talking about, what they're trading, right through to then using some of the tools that we have, which are unfortunately not available for every individual investor, but some of the what we call screens. So the idea of setting some criteria and mm-hmm. finding which companies match that criteria. And again, because we're bottom up and we're not particularly formulaic, we kind of can start anywhere. So I would literally look for companies that sometimes are trading at low PEs, trying to find the value stocks. It might be the high growth stocks that often can be actually undervalued by the market because investors don't put enough faith or enough stock in the compound effect of that growth. So really, really different ends of the market. We're not value investors per se. We're not even really high growth investors per se. We'll kind of fish anywhere and go anywhere for the opportunity. The real idea is to find something that's interesting about a company, whether it's a trend, whether it's an idea, whether it's a new product, whether it's a new geography or business, or literally find it from the numbers and say, right, let's look at all the low PE stocks, look at the high growth stocks. Let's look at the companies that are maybe out of favor is a great way. So 52-week lows, 52-week highs, they're not in themselves the only places to find the ideas. They're the starting point. And then when you get a list, you might say, well, I haven't looked at company X for a while. Speaking of Wax, we'll go with the X. we're not going to necessarily, I haven't looked at that for a while. I'll go and have a look. Or, hey, that's fallen a decent amount since last time I looked at it. I'll go and have another look and see if there's some value apparent there. So it's kind of a really unsatisfactory answer in one case because there's not a simple set of tools or programs that we use to simply identify formulaically winners. We're looking right across the board. I mean, our recent stocks have been everything from Kogan to Nine Entertainment to, everything in between. So really, really broad. And it just comes down to, does the market see what we see? And if it doesn't, and we think we see a brighter future, and particularly the given share price, that's where the opportunities can come from.
Okay. It's not an unsatisfactory answer. It's a great answer.
Very kind.
It's a great answer in that, for many investors, they don't give 100% of their time to find the stocks.
Yeah.
Because you do, mm-hmm. you have the opportunity to kind of play a lot of different angles. And I think that's really fun for people.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Look, it's about trying to find what the market's missing. We're huge fans of ETFs, right? So for some people, if you want to just match the market return, go fishing, go shopping, go play with kids, then ETFs are wonderful. So if you're going to pick stocks, you want to pick stocks because you think you can do better than the market? Because if you can't, then don't do it, right? Buy an ETF and go fishing. Mm. If you think you can or want to beat the market or you enjoy the process, then it's a matter of trying to find the companies that the market's wrong about. Now, quite frankly, here's the other thing is it's really, really mentally and emotionally challenging to try and do that because if the market's wrong about a company, and again, we'll pick zero because I mentioned it before. If I think the market's wrong about zero, then I'm going to buy its shares, right? Assuming I think the market's undervaluing it. Or rather overvalue, which is a whole different story.
Yeah.
Now, if I buy zero shares today, to expect the market's going to all of a sudden realize its error tomorrow just because I bought the stock is unrealistic. And so you might find 3, 6, even 12 months after you buy a stock, the shares might have gone nowhere. They might even be down further because, again, the market still has its own perspective, right? And so to beat the market, you have to do something different to the market. Then don't expect the market to all of a sudden come around your way of thinking. You just can't do it. It doesn't work that way, right? So it's the mental discipline, the emotional challenge of waiting until the market sees it your way. Or maybe you are wrong, by the way, and you've made the mistake and then you sell. But if you're waiting for the market to see it your way, you've got to have patience. You've got to have some sort of fortitude or some ability to simply kind of wear that. Because for the longest time, you can look like a deal while you wait for the market to come around to your way of thinking, if it ever does.
That's even more challenging for you, I imagine, because you put your stuff in the public domain. The rest of us, when we get it wrong, just have to, we just hide it.
Don't tell anyone. Right? So the beauty is if you've got a track record that's half decent, you can at least say, look, here's what I've done. We do have occasionally members will say, well, all your old stocks are doing well, but your new ones aren't doing very well. And we have to explain exactly that story of, like, if we're doing well with the old stocks, it's because we've given them time to kind of mature, to prove out, right? The new ones, I say regularly, after 12 months, you can assume that half our stocks are up and half are down. Just because the law of averages is that that's just what will happen. Just, you know, it's almost a distribution at some point. Over time, if you're right, the longer you hold those stocks, for the most part, if you are right, you'll be proven right. And if you're wrong, you'll be proven wrong. But you've got to give those time to mature. So if you're any good at this, yes, your older picks will be better because they've actually, the thesis has played out. The stuff that's still in the middle is the stuff you won't be right on straight away. And again, it's so hard to do. You look at your portfolio, it's down again, it's down again, it's down again. Or you're flat, the market's up. And you think, oh, I've missed that opportunity or I've bought the wrong stocks. You've just got to be disciplined and be prepared to wait to be proven out.
I like that theory a lot. So today's topic is a great one for that. I think it's absolutely perfect. We're going to talk about WACC. So we've had explicit questions on this. Can you please cover the acronym? Australia's finally got its own tech acronym.
I know, about time, right?
There's FANG, there's BAT, there's STAT, there's all the acronyms. We've got our own now. We're so excited. Should I throw all my money at it? Tell us about the acronym first. Cool. What are we talking about?
So WACC is the acronym. And depending on how long you've been doing this, the number of A's in that keeps growing, right? I think it was like 2 to start with. Now there's 3. So give it long enough. So WACC is the Australian tech kind of vanguard, if you like. And so in order, the A's I won't do in any particular order, but WiseTech's the W. Mm-hmm. Then you've got Appen, Altium, and Afterpay. We've got 3 A's in the middle. And Xero, the X at the end. And these have been... Xero is kind of the granddaddy of them all, which sounds weird to say, right? Because it's only been 4 or 5 years that it's actually been really dominant on the Australian market. But that's been long enough that it's the oldest of the lot in terms of the kind of performance and awareness that the public has. The W and the A's, they're kind of newer to the party. And they've, as a group, been doing incredibly well. In fact, over the last, I want to say, 12 months, maybe 2 years, they've actually beaten the FANG stocks. You mentioned FANG, which are the American Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. They've actually put FANG in the shade, which is saying something. Now, is it good or is it bad? That's a whole different question. But right now, it's been for the last 12, 18 months, the place to be on Australian investing. Very hard to have beaten the market without those stocks, particularly when you think about the banks and the miners haven't exactly set the world on fire recently. It's been Australia's tech that's really risen to the top and really captured your listeners' imagination and the rest of the market's imagination as well.
Your point about being so difficult to beat the market if you didn't hold these stocks has played out because I think 85% of fund managers are underwater. Relative to the benchmark, negative,
yes.
But relative to the benchmark over the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. And it's largely because of this little group stripping out.
In the US, I don't know the numbers in Australia, but in the US, the FANG stocks, they're frankly much bigger than our WACC stocks, both in absolute terms and relative to their markets. But the FANGs are responsible for something like, and I'll make the number up, 80, 85, 90% of the total US market's gains have been in those 4 FANG stocks over a decent period of time. And so if you, again, to your point, if you haven't been in those stocks, it's almost impossible to beat the market. And this is where it's been hard for some people and why we see so much volatility in these stocks, particularly, as I said, we'll talk about WACC in a sec, but for FANGs last year, November, December, when the US market kind of took a big hit and tech stocks fell, you had people who were buying them and owned them because they felt like they almost had to. You know, there was no conviction there. There was a sense of, I'm going to hold my nose, I'm going to buy these because I kind of need to be in them. And as soon as things start to go south, you almost hear the sigh of relief of, thank goodness I can now sell these things.
Yeah.
And so that really did play into that lack of confidence in November, December in tech, and that flowed through here, by the way, because we kind of tend to, you know, catch the wave the US is sending to us, no matter which way it's blowing. That's a mixed metaphor for you there. We know which way the waves are breaking, maybe put it that way. Mm. That's been very much the story. And so, you know, there are some people, and some in Australia, I'm sure, with WACC, and they'll be volatile as well, because there's a whole lot of people who own them because they feel like they should, because reputationally, if you're a fund manager, you don't own them, then what are you doing? Market-wise, as you say, because there's so much of the gain coming from those stocks. You need to have them as part of your portfolio just to deliver market-ish returns. If you're lagging, you're probably, you know, to be lagging only by a little bit, you still have to own them. You're lagging by a lot if you've left them behind. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. We talked about taking time for theses to play out. But if you're a fund manager and people are going to desert you after 3 or 6 or 12 months of underperformance, there's real fund risk, there's real career risk in not having the stocks that are doing the right thing and that are really delivering strong gains on the ASX.
Your point is excellent. And I think in Australia, it's particularly hard. So if you don't hold the FANG stocks in the US and you're hurting, they're mega caps, right? They're absolutely enormous stocks. And they are also, we're discussing this thesis before we came on, they're also consumer stocks, as in everybody knows what they are and how to use them. My three-year-old knows how to use them. They're amazingly accessible.
Yes,
let's put
it
that way. So they hold people's attention for many reasons, not simply because they're such enormous stocks, but because they're such accessible companies and people know what they're buying when they buy them.
Not just accessible, they're ubiquitous. They are literally everywhere. You can't go through a day without using probably at least three of those. If you can get through a day without using Facebook and Netflix, Facebook and Google, you've done well. Netflix and Amazon maybe every couple of days, but yeah, most people go a week without using the FANG stocks products.
Yes.
Really, really unlikely.
Yeah, and then if they go with the FANG, with the Apple as well, there'd be people who wouldn't go minutes without using them. You know, it's amazing how, you're absolutely right, they are ubiquitous in our lives. That is not true of wax, right?
Yep.
Is not true. So to lose so much performance relative to the benchmark for things that are not ubiquitous in people's lives must hurt a little bit.
Yeah, I think it does. And it's really hard for, it kind of goes both ways, right? On one hand, when you don't know them, it's hard to buy them. The other hand, it's kind of, there's your Peter Lynch line of buying what you know. And there's some value in that, right? You can use Facebook and see what it's doing, how it's doing. You can get a sense as a consumer, even though we're the product when it comes to Facebook, rather than the customer, you know, advertisers are the customer. But you get a sense of what they're doing, how they're doing. Am I using Facebook more or less? Is it likely to be, you know, am I stickier or am I not? Netflix, again, great series coming out. Love that show. More people are going to sign up. Okay, I kind of get the thesis, right? No one really says, you know what, Altium's doing a really great job making, you know, software printed circuit boards. I've seen that everywhere these days. All my friends are using Altium, you know, printed circuit board software. I should buy that stock. It's hard to get into. The flip side is also true, though, because you don't notice the changes in the market. So how do you know about Altium in the first place? How do you know when to buy it based on any sort of experience you can't? And then on the flip side, if and when the price gets too high or the quality of the company starts to falter, how do you see that either? And so you can do the research, but it is, as you're referring, a much higher bar to know these companies well, to justifiably invest in them, to hold them, and then to sell them at the right time if you're going to sell them. Based on any sort of experience, you really have to either do deep research or find someone you trust and know to give you that insight. Otherwise, you're kind of at sea. And again, I'll talk about the fund managers holding FANGs who are kind of glad to be rid of them. The real challenge comes when these stocks, if and when they start to decline, do you think, well, the funds are ever going to get out? And so the motivation that got you in, which is to some degree, some people say, I know these well, I want to buy them, I love them. Other people, there's a bit of FOMO, quite frankly, the whole fear of missing out. I guess I better buy them because everyone else is, they're going up so much, I don't want to miss out. If and when they start falling, how do you know when to get out? Again, the emotional elements of the buy decision also hit the sell decision. It makes it much, much harder and potentially much more volatile. Because if you see Google shares falling, you might say, well, people are selling Google, but I still like it, I still know the company. Or frankly, other people saying, I'll buy more because I already liked it and so now's a chance. Half people say, gee, Altium shares are falling. I think I've got a much brighter future. I never followed it before, but now I'm going to buy some stock. So it does make it potentially much more volatile. And so you either need to be able to trade against that if you want to, or just be emotionally prepared to manage those feelings as and when that happens.
Okay, so I think you're absolutely right. I feel very strongly that I am not an expert in most of these things.
Right.
I am not a tech boffin. I have no desire to be a tech boffin. I kind of work with some tech boffins.
That's why it's helpful someone else is doing it. Totally. I agree.
Oh, but on the NabTrade side, obviously, it's a technology-based platform, right? Yeah. So there are people who know technology inside and out, and they can probably give me a well-informed view on some of these things. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of my other colleagues, investors, and so on wouldn't have a clue the technology side.
It's a combination of tech, but it's also, as you mentioned, it's B2B, right? So it's not just purely tech. It's also that the tech is enabling a B2B transaction that even if you know the tech, you've got to have some view of the company and the industry and the competitive set. So why is tech's business in freight forwarding? You probably find a very, very small number of people who can give you a really good summary of the freight forwarding industry and or the tech. Try and do both together, that overlapping Venn diagram of people who know enough about freight forwarding and enough about the tech that powers it, that's a really, really small group. So to your point, even if you know part of that, trying to work out what happens both, and again, this is a global business, you add that geographical kind of diversification, At some point, you have to either have done the research or make a judgment call to say, well, I know about as much as I'm going to, and here's how I'm going to approach this particular investment in terms of portfolio weighting, buy and sell decisions, the way I'm going to consider that as part of my portfolio when I can't have as much information and knowledge about it as I might have about a Woolworths or a Wesfarm or something like that.
Anything that I can experience personally.
Totally.
Which we'll talk about Afterpay a little bit later, but my feeling is one of the reasons it's so popular is that many individuals have a personal experience with it. And I find this really fascinating. I have an interest in design.
Okay.
And some of the design groups that I've belonged to, people started, this would be 2 years ago, saying, oh, I'm dying to buy this particular product or design thing.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. Do they have Afterpay?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was like, do they have what?
exactly.
And also coming from a finance background, you can't pay for it yet.
Right,
like,
right.
Should you be... Do you need a thing to make sure you pay for it? Like, that was quite a weird thing. It was like, why would you need Afterpay? Is that a thing?
Totally.
And it became a thing. Yeah. So everyone was asking, does this particular product provider, does this particular retailer have Afterpay?
Mm.
And I will only make this purchase if they have Afterpay. So that was how it came on my radar, completely separate to the market, which was quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Let's talk about WiseTech first. Tell me about WiseTech.
All right. So again, you know, I'm not a freight forwarder nor a tech expert, but basically one of the great trends in tech at the moment is the removing of friction. Maybe that's always been the trend in tech, quite frankly. If you think about removing friction, right? So making any process or transaction or engagement easier, simpler, faster, that's kind of where a lot of the opportunity is in tech and where a lot of the advances are being made. And WiseTech systems basically allow for the end-to-end, without using too much jargon here, the end-to-end connection of the freight forwarding process. So there were a whole lot of different people doing a whole lot of different jobs, lots of paper flying across desks. Think about if you're sending a particular freight package from a warehouse in Melbourne, it might go in the warehouse to a truck, truck to a port, port to a ship. At the other end, the exact reverse happens in everywhere from the US to China to India to the UK to Vietnam, choose your country. That is a whole lot of paper going a whole lot of different directions. And I mean, it was a really, really difficult thing to join up as an end-to-end from the sender to the recipient. Very, very complex, very, very difficult. And so what WiseTech allows companies to do is basically both make it cheaper, easier, and a more trackable solution both for them and their customers to say, I know what it is, I know where it's going, I know when it's getting there, I know who's got control of it and how it's being handled. So a really, really simple, on one level, this is a very, very, very basic kind of, you know, the history of global trade type solution, right?
Mm.
And it's almost not a surprise that it's happening. The difference is WiseTech is the first company to really do it very, very well and do it in a joined up way. Now, the other benefit of WiseTech is that it's a network effect business. Now, we talk about network effects. I'm sure you've covered it before on the podcast. The idea that each new member of a system or a network adds exponential value to that network. So the third and the fourth and the fifth person, as each one joins, it makes the rest of the network much more valuable. WiseTech's value is exactly that. More and more people are using WiseTech solutions. And so when it gets a critical mass, well, if I'm already using it, you're probably going to want to use it because you know I'm on it.
Yeah.
And then so on and so forth. So each node of the network makes the network more valuable, attracts more users to it. And WiseTech's kind of, I wouldn't say it's past that tipping point because it's still an incredibly fragmented global industry. There's so many participants, so many different places. But WiseTech's the first company to really do a single solution or set of solutions, but a single viewpoint, a single piece of software or range of software that links together to really give as many people as possible full access to that supply chain, if you like. And so that's the key WiseTech proposition. Really, really simple freight forwarding. It's kind of super old school, right? But if you can systematize it, make it easy to use, cheaper, faster, more informative, that's what they've done differently. And again, it's partly the tech, but it's more about the network that it's built in doing so.
Mm.
That's the real strength of the WiseTech business.
And the problem that it's solved, which is
you got
enormous.
It. Yeah, exactly. And it's a... The little frictional points, you know, a tiny subsidy. Think about the cost of any product. The freight cost is tiny. And of that, the freight forwarding kind of administrative component is even smaller. But at scale, there's real, real value both for the customers and for WiseTech in solving that problem.
I think also from a risk management perspective, making sure you know where everything is fundamental, right?
Yeah,
that you
totally.
Didn't lose it halfway along.
Yeah, you got this right.
You know where you lost it if it did get lost.
And in an e-commerce world, we are so much more we're so much more fussy now about where things are when we're getting them, right? The older was, it'll be there in a couple of weeks. Okay, cool. And it turns out, oh, wow, that's surprising. Now, if we're waiting more than a day, we're like, where is that parcel I've waited for? You know, why isn't it here? And so the ability to do that in a seamless way, it does make it faster or quicker anyway, but it also means your customers stay informed.
Mm.
They feel more comfortable with you as a supplier. They feel more comfortable knowing where the delivery is. They're used to that. And so it's the freight forwarding solution of almost the Amazon Prime 2-day shipping solution, right? Where you know exactly where it is, who's got it, and when you're likely to receive it.
So your view, I find this really interesting. And I've just read my notes. The CEO is 24. Is that correct?
Phenomenal, isn't it? These are some smart, smart people. And this is, so, you know, the
value. And also, the other thing I loved was one of the first reviews, if you look them up, is fun and chill place to work.
There you go. Can I get any better than that? A freight forwarding software company, right? Believe it or not. This is why tech is so phenomenal right now. And it's why it's very, very hard to genuinely pin down the value of some of these companies, because when you can go from an idea to a dominant platform in literally, you know, months, not months of a year, but, you know, 24, 36 months, right? We're talking tiny, tiny amounts of time. Woolies probably went from one store to two across 5 years. Right now it's at 1,000 some 70 years later. When you can create an international software platform that literally takes over the world in a small number of years, that's how fast tech is moving and how fast fortunes can be made and lost, by the way. But that's why this is so exciting as an area to be looking for investment ideas, because these things can just explode so quickly, as you mentioned with your Afterpay example before.
So it sounds like you like this one.
I love the company. So there'll be a theme through some of these wax conversations, which is I'm super impressed by what they've been able to achieve. I think that's really, really smart. I think they've been they found an idea. They found a great solution, because you can't, you know, they need to go together. You can't have a solution without an idea without a solution. And they've been able to get adoption in a really, really fast way. I think that is phenomenally good. What I worry about, and again, this will come up also with some of the other stocks, is the valuation. So there's one thing about loving the company, they're about loving the valuation. And I think to some degree, you should be a little bit careful about how much you're prepared to pay for some of this blue sky, because effectively what some of the price on is pulled forward a lot of that future gain. Amazon is $2,000 a share now, right? Now, if you said, well, okay, markets are supposed to gain 10% a year, then 5 years ago it should have been selling for $1,000 and 5 years before that $500. Now, we know that most of the Amazon gains in dollar terms have come in the last 3 or 4 years because the market's caught up really late to where that opportunity's come through. Amazon was $100 and it was $9 and it was back. You know, it's spent a lot of time in the single double-digit prices, really taken off recently while the thesis has been proven out. Because there's so much heat, so much excitement, so much kind of expectation around tech, a lot of that has been pulled forward. So if Amazon had been selling $1,500 5 years ago, you wouldn't get anywhere near the gains you've received by holding the shares for the long term and getting the gains in the last little while. So it always matters the price you pay. I will say, for full disclosure, I own Amazon shares. I feel like I should disclose that. I love the business. I think the shares are expensive, and I don't think it's a risk-free investment, but I think I'll give away the hint now. Of the five WACC stocks, I think it's the one that has the best probability of max. I think it's likely to have the best return of the five of them on any sort of reasonable, rational basis. So it doesn't mean what others can't beat them, but if you were to assess them all at their current prices and say, in 5 years' time, which is likely to be doing best, I think Y6 is probably the one that's there, because that installed base, it's a B2B business, as you say, super sticky, really, really great business. So if I own them, I'd hold them. I don't know, I'd buy them at the current price.
I like that answer. That's excellent. It's really cool, right? So, you know, thinking about the value of something. Some of these businesses are a real challenge.
Yeah.
I like to use the Snapchat example, where it was nothing, then it was everything.
Yes.
Then Kylie Jenner said she didn't like it and it was nothing. Yep. You know, like, it's amazing how quickly the network effects can turn off in some cases.
That's right. And so whether they're real or not, I mean, MySpace was the example. MySpace was dominant social network platform, right? It had more users than any other social network by a factor of X, whatever the number was. And then within a couple of years, it was literally gone. I mean, it still exists, but it was effectively gone as an entity because Facebook simply wrote over the top of it. So network effects are great. A, they have to be real, and some can look real until they're taken away. But B, they've got to be sizable enough that no one can come and take that network by simply being bigger. Because if you love MySpace, you're there because your friends were there. Then as Facebook got bigger and bigger and bigger, you couldn't afford not to be on Facebook. And then when everyone was on Facebook, you didn't need a second network anymore, so MySpace fell by the wayside. Now, there's the Instagrams, the Facebooks, the Snapchats, the WhatsApps, the whole lot of that. Do we really need that many different social networks? Maybe in time we will. I don't know the answer to that. But you should be really mindful that, as you say, at some point, what you think is a network effect, and WiseTech could have the same problem, right? It's really, really fragmented, has a small share of an enormous industry, which means there's plenty of opportunity for someone to come and do a WiseTech to WiseTech, so we have a better or cheaper or faster or something solution that may well take that business away from it. And so we need to be a little bit careful and mindful that growth we think is coming, particularly at the current price, continues to be delivered. If it starts to falter, that's probably a good sign to sell.
Okay, that is cool. So let's talk about Afterpay, because...
Everyone else is.
As I was saying to you when we were coming up here, Afterpay was in the top 10 most traded stocks on NavTrade last year. That is a big deal for tiny stock.
Yeah, yeah.
We see the big four banks, AMP, Macquarie, Rio, BHP, Wesfarmers, Woolies, and CSL.
And Afterpay.
That's generally our top 10, plus Afterpay.
That is amazing, isn't it?
It's an astonishing change to see, and that has not changed in the first part of this year at all. In fact, probably become more exciting for people.
So as we record this, Afterpay is now bigger than AMP in market cap terms. So to give
as of today's yesterday's movements,
it must be yesterday or before, sometime this week. It's now bigger than AMP. So again, AMP's got its own troubles, and we can talk about that. But to give your listeners a sense of size and scale, you mentioned those list of companies, and most of those are still much bigger than Afterpay. But it's not only volume traded but or value traded, but now also just in sheer market cap terms, it's really joined the big boys. Yeah.
So AMP, we're recording this a day after AMP announced their results, and they are having a bit of a rough time of it.
Yeah.
Best we can say about that. So Afterpay, fascinating rise, took off like crazy. Real consumer demand for it, just based on my own personal observation, let's call it that. But I would imagine that every millennial listening to this and younger would also be able to observe that phenomenon, right? It's a very real phenomenon of consumer demand for this product. Goes to the moon, bit of regulatory risk becomes apparent. So the Senate says we're going to start looking at these sort of quasi-credit providers, falls apart. Comes roaring back again. So we're back to nearly where we started, or nearly where we reached.
That's right.
Not where we started, where we reached last year. So back to the highs. What are your thoughts?
So Afterpay is fascinating. I think to your point about seeing people start to use it, this was an absolute consumer phenomenon. And the number of stores that started offering it, and then when the big chain started offering it, was phenomenal. I'm still incredibly impressed. So I talk about WiseTech doing so well. I think Afterpay as a business has done a phenomenal job. If you think about the competitors, we're talking about Amex, MasterCard, Visa, UnionPay out of China. These are big, globally dominant behemoth companies worth tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars. Australia's bank card couldn't compete, right? Shut down because the others were too big. Afterpay comes along as a basically a tech startup and says, hey, no, we're going to take these guys on and we're going to try and carve ourselves out a sustainable niche. I don't know anyone who would have given it even the slightest chance, right? In fact, Afterpay itself, so TouchCorp was the old company before they merged, which was providing software that Afterpay happened to use to try and enable its business. And they merged because that kind of changed. TouchCorp was an old, it produced software for redeemable gift cards in Europe, right? So this was how the business started. It had some tech that Afterpay started to use. Fast forward even 6-12 months, this thing has just gone through the roof. The consumer adoption has been phenomenal. And as you say, it's to some degree, it's gamified, it's appified payments in a really, really fascinating way. There was already the Flexi Group company, Flexi Rent, Certegy Easy Pay, the Harvey Norman 50 months interest free stuff. It wasn't like there was a dearth of ability to pay for stuff over time. People had credit cards, got FBOS cards, all that kind of stuff. Part of its existence was, well, why wouldn't I use it? So it's on my phone, I can just tap the phone, I take it to my account later. It feels painless, it feels seamless, removing friction that we talked about. This is exactly what Afterpay has managed to capitalize on. And again, this is a model that's born in Australia. We're not copying someone else doing it somewhere else. This is literally the whole idea is now being exported to the States. But the very idea was invented here by some really smart, capable, forward-thinking guys who've done a wonderful job. So I love the success story. It's a really, really great story. Adoption-wise, to your point, maybe I should have said it earlier too, because again, the Peter Lynch buy what you know, you're seeing everybody use it. So the brand popping up everywhere, the labels, the stickers are on the shop fronts. We're seeing it online. At some point, again, if I go back a couple of years, you might think, well, maybe you should be buying this stuff if it's growing so quickly and doing so well. So that's been a really, really fantastic success story. Where Afterpay remains unproven is in a couple of areas. The first is that you mentioned the regulatory risk. I have a personal view, which is actually outside the investment purview, which is just simply that Afterpay should be regulated as a credit product. If you're providing, they get through a loophole, sounds like I'm being critical. There's the Credit Act only applies if you're charging interest to a customer. They're not, they're getting paid by the retailer. So they get to say, hey, no, we're not really a credit product. We're just, you know, I don't know what they say where they are, because if you're not credit, I don't know what you are. But they're not that, apparently. They're not covered by the Credit Act for that exact reason. They're not charging interest to me as a consumer, so they can get away with it. I think they should be regulated, because if you've got a mortgage that's overdue, three credit cards that are overdue, you can still use Afterpay. And so it's potentially as a credit product, and it is, should be treated accordingly. Now, maybe there should be different grades of credit worthiness, credit assessment, based on what product you give, or the time frames, or the dollar value. So there's some value there that can be dissected, and maybe work out how that's being done. I say that, A, as a personal view, and frankly, as a we kind of like to, you know, we're kind of personal finance guys at The Fool, as well as being investors. And so on behalf of our customers and our potential customers and investors and consumers generally, I don't love the idea there's more credit being washed in the market without a know your customer kind of requirement. That being said, that regulatory risk I think still remains. And I don't believe, so there's definitely a risk that we have to revisit the regulatory problems. I think it only takes one round of particularly economic hardship potentially, or a decent number of people who are all of a sudden finding themselves in hardship because of the use of this product, and we're back in front of the Senate, or we're back in front of the regulator or something else to try and resolve this. So that remains a real issue. If there's a handrail put on the adoption of Afterpay, the usage of Afterpay, the credit requirements for Afterpay, that potentially changes materially its growth path. And I think that's a really important one to look at. I said that also because as they expand into the US, which we'll get to in a sec, the same potential applies, right? So as and when a government or regulatory body takes a different approach to Afterpay, they may well find themselves in different waters. So that's kind of still out there and to be discussed. But the company's doing really well. The other thing we don't know yet is what happens in those times of economic hardship in terms of the company's bad debts. They're keeping all of that risk on their books currently. Now, they get paid by the retailers. That's, they're getting their income that way. But up to, and the number's fallen a little bit recently, but it was up to about 20% of the company's revenue came from late fees. Now, I don't know anyone else, and I'm mindful that NAB obviously has credit products, so you may or may not be able to keep talking. You may have to just sit there quietly while I talk. I'm not sure, depending on what your compliance rules are. But I'll keep talking, and you can tell me, you can jump back in. The concern I have is that if you have any product that relies on 20% of its value coming from people who can't meet the terms of the product you're offering, I find that hard to understand, again, from a regulatory perspective, from a business perspective, how that's even a sustainable business in and of itself, right? And if that's in good times, when unemployment's effectively at record lows, close enough to, economic growth's pretty good, inflation's under control, that's happening now. If you fast forward to a time when, who knows how far away it is, when the economy is in a bit of a funk, unemployment goes from 5 to 7 or 8%, bad debts rise, home loan delinquencies rise, have people really got the money to meet their Afterpay obligations? And in that case, does Afterpay have the balance sheet to actually absorb that stuff? And so it's one of these businesses that I think is still tightrope-ish. It wouldn't take much to push it off that tightrope if bad times hit and it was underprepared and frankly undercapitalized. And so we don't yet know how that happens. So they're two big watch-outs. Now, I had those concerns at $5 and the shares are $30. So, you know, it's for all I know, right, the knowing the risks and being able to assess the price are two very different things. Long answer, I'll come to the end of it soon. Back to the fundamentals. This is where, as an investor, all you can do is say, fundamentally, does it look attractive enough, given the risks, given the upside, given the price, do I want to buy the shares? We can't and don't at the Motley Fool try and say, well, the price will go to here. We don't do price targets. We don't do forecasts. We don't do any of this because, you know, it's just very, very difficult to do. I don't think anyone can do it, frankly, but different people disagree. If that's the reality, I don't know where the Afterpay share price is going next. What I do know is there are some really significant risks that are almost existential risks at some point. And so I want a pretty good price for that. I'm not sure I want to pay $6.5-7 billion in total for a company that has those meaningful existential risks from a balance sheet perspective and meaningful handbrake risks when it comes to the actual regulation of it, of its products and what that might do to its revenues. If you see revenues fall or simply growth stop, this is a very, very expensive business. So I'm not buying Afterpay. I don't think people should buy Afterpay for what it's worth. It makes me unpopular. Also makes me look like I'm losing it. And, you know, the shares keep rising. I keep saying no. And so the longer they rise, the sillier I look.
Well, you look pretty good when they drop back to $12.
Well, there you go. That's right. Next time they drop, I'll claim that one as well. Yeah. That's why I talk about the bits in between. So, yeah, from a fundamental perspective, I don't think it's attractively enough priced now. I don't think any accounting for the risk is in the share price. And that worries me as an investor. I think it means it's too risky to be buying the shares today.
So two other, same sphere, right? People love them. Zip and Splitit, which are also getting huge amounts of attention from our investors. And it looks, if I look at the trading patterns, very much like people are trading the sector.
All right.
Okay. So today I'm going to take my profits in Afterpay and put them in Zip because I think Zip's got a bit of upside this week. Yeah. And, you know, it's a real really churning's, again, it sounds like I'm judging. I'm not. I'm just, like people are actively trading that sector to pick a winner over a very short time frame sometimes. I'm guessing you have the same concerns given their business models.
I do. I think, yes, the business model risk is absolutely true. So on Afterpay, the other thing I didn't mention was that the US expansion, there's a whole lot of blue sky in the price for the US success.
Yeah.
If it succeeds in the US, by the way, the shares are worth more than the current price. So yep. But again, we could have said, and we'll get to Xero in a second, but 5 years ago, that was the promise for Xero at $50. Mm-hmm. Was when it succeeds in the US, then it'll be worth X. Now, it didn't achieve that, and so now we are where we are. So there's a lot of expectation in the price for Afterpay, and that's, you can take or leave that, but that's in there. Frankly, I actually like Zip more than Afterpay for that reason. We're not paying anywhere near as much for Zip in multiples of earnings, of sales, and if Afterpay can prove out the concept, i.e. buy now, pay later, if it's here to stay, and Zip is a potential alternative, then at the current market cap, the current share price, Zip, I think, is a much more attractive way to play that sector if you want to. Not as much blue sky, way less downside. And so from my perspective as a fundamentals-based investor, I'd be much happier to say, look, if the sector succeeds, I'll take Zip. If it doesn't, then there's just not as much downside. I mean, if it dies altogether, then they're all going to zero, so it's not a big deal. But if the growth doesn't come through for Afterpay, the shares come back a long way, there's nowhere near as much of that expectation in the Zip share price. The third one on that is actually split it. I think that's an interesting business way, way early. I don't have an investment view on that at the moment.
Yeah.
What I like about that is it actually uses the credit card payment systems of the Visas and MasterCards. That takes the debt off its books, which is positive. It also means that it doesn't have to do the same creditworthiness checks. So it may well be in the fullness of time, split it actually has a competitive advantage in a different regulatory environment. Now, if that environment never plays out, then split it doesn't have that advantage and maybe is even a disadvantage because it has to liaise with those credit card providers. But in an environment where that credit regulation changes or the oversight changes, split it actually might be the dark horse in this race. So I wouldn't be buying shares now, but I'd be keeping a close eye on it. I think its business model is more sustainable if the regulators come down a bit harder. If they don't, it's probably a disadvantage because it's a bit more complex than an extra step in the process that you have to already have a credit card. So the number of customers is potentially smaller. So I'm on the fence on split it. I think it's well worth watching. I'll be watching it closely. That might be the dark horse in an environment where regulations get a bit tighter.
That's really interesting. The demographic focus has to be different too, obviously. Yes. If you have to have a credit card, then the 18-year-old is not your market.
Right, and that's the fascinating thing about where Afterpay has been successful is you mentioned the millennials. It's absolutely been that market. Now, for what it's worth, my boss, who's about 10 years older than me, and I won't give away either of our ages, has started using Afterpay. He's like, this is great. This is really easy. So it's winning the adoption war, right?
Why?
So,
right. Why is he using it?
Because he can. And this is what I mean, the gamification thing. He's got the money, isn't he? Doesn't do it for the money.
I'm assuming he can pay for things upfront.
But why pay upfront, right? His view is, well, I can use it, and it's on the phone, and it's easy. So there's no reason not to. If I'm going to pay by Google Pay or Apple Pay on my phone anyway, I'll use the Afterpay app instead. Same kind of hand movement, right? You do the same thing to pay the bill, and they pay it off over 4 weeks rather than right now. Well, where's the downside? Why wouldn't you do it? So at some level, there's that sense of it's almost too easy not to use, which is a real success again for the product. Question, of course, remains about whether it can sustain that growth and whether it just becomes a fad of, I used it a couple of times, but I can pay the bill. I don't need to worry about it. Let's not bother. That still remains an open question. I don't know it'll necessarily stick with that generation, but to the extent it does, you see the market growing meaningfully from here.
That example is amazing to me. Amazing.
I'm probably never going to use it myself either, by the way, but he is, and he's loving it. So I was like, okay, well,
Well, there you go. Different market. So let's talk about Altium now. Yes. They are based in San Diego. Founded in Tasmania.
Yeah.
My husband will be so proud. He's a Tasman.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Is it anything from Tasmania?
Well, he's an AFL team, they'll be fine.
Yeah, no, he supports the Lions.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, some complex thing, Fitzroy or something or other. I don't know. I didn't. I've tried not to pay any attention. Sure. Anyway, so around since the 80s, completely different business model. This one I put in the category of stuff very few people know a lot about.
Yep.
Tell us about it.
So Altium's probably the one of those five. So I mentioned WiseTech having the best risk-adjusted probable return over 5 years. Altium's the one that has the best foundation right now. So it makes software that allows people to design printed circuit boards. Now, that phrase is probably right over most people's
heads.
They're literally the computer chips. So if you think about the silicon chip with the wires and the diodes and the... exactly. The things and doobas and whatsies. When you're making those at scale, the ability to design those used to be pen and paper, then it was kind of proprietary desktop software. Like everything, it's going to a SaaS model, software as a service. So now anyone anywhere in the world can buy an Altium subscription. And it's, I think of it like, so computer-aided design was a thing, right, back in the day. You'd be able to mock up something on a computer and show how it might look in 3D in real time, that kind of stuff. This is the printed circuit. This is a computer version of exactly that. And all of a sudden now you can start to design devices, equipment, chips that can actually go in these things. So they'll Fitbit on your wrist, or the, I don't know if Apple uses it directly, but these kind of ideas, right? Those devices that need these things, that's what this Altium software allows people to do. And it's doing a really great job of delivering a really great process. This is almost, it's SaaS, right? So it's new tech and it's exciting, it's whatever, but it's almost pretty old school. It's literally, you know, they are the best provider of the best software at the right price in the market. And they're gaining market share hand over fist. They're just growing like Topsy because they're convincing more and more people that this is the best solution to go and build those computers. It's kind of, it feels almost flippant to say that, but that's exactly what it is. The old thing of just giving the right product at the right price that, you know, does what it's supposed to do, it's kind of as easy as that. And so to the extent we're all using Google Docs now, a lot of us using Google Docs for writing or sharing or Gmail, this is, again, software as a service kind of idea. You log into Altium, you do that, use their software to design the computer chips of today and tomorrow. And that's been a really, really successful story. They are continuing to just gain market share hand over fist because it's a better solution. And there's a bit of network effect. They're not as much as a WiseTech, but the sense that if you're going to collaborate with somebody, design and production or manufacturing, the ability to do that on a single platform, again, around the world, without worrying about which office you're in or what geography you're in, I can use it, you can use it, the manufacturer can use it. It's a much, much easier and more seamless way of sharing that information amongst a group of people. And again, doing it at a really, really good scale. Interestingly enough, too, they've convinced the Chinese to start paying for it, which is relatively uncommon in China. We know there's IP issues. We know the trade war has largely been about that with the US and China. Altium has got really strong growth in the last couple of years from their Chinese subscribers. They're paying the bills. Hard not to not have pirated software in China. We know that there's not a lot of, you know, high-level government kind of oversight of that stuff, and there's arguments about whether the Chinese government are doing it or not, or to what degree they're doing it. More importantly, though, is that they've convinced the customers that the current version of the software in the cloud, delivered to them directly, is actually worth paying for. Mm. And when you can get someone, it's a little bit like the old story of maybe there was pirated music, and then Spotify came out, and Apple Music, and everything else. Well, we might as well just pay for it because it's cheap enough, right? The Altium software has become that. Yeah, we can use an old pirated version, but it doesn't cost us that much more to buy Altium. It's the brand new version of the software. We like it. It's better. It's faster. It's newer. We actually want to pay the money to get the latest thing. And when you can do that, that's a really good sign that you've got a product that's worth paying for, rather than I'll rip off the old version and just use that. I'll download it somewhere. I'll pirate it somewhere. This is literally, I'll pay for the current version because it's worth the money. It's actually worth, it's, you know, the other stuff was worth paying zero for. This is worth paying the subscription fee for because it gives you exactly what you want. And that's another sign that it's a really sticky, valuable product, where people are choosing to pay you rather than getting what they could otherwise get for free with an older version.
That's exciting for something that sounds kind of special. Yeah. It sounds very niche, but obviously enormous market globally. Yes. Tell us about the company. Do you like the company?
Actually. Yeah, like the price, it's about 60-odd times earnings at the moment. So again, it's hard to like any of these stocks on a valuation basis, right? They're just, so much has to go right from here. If this trades on a PE of 15 eventually, a profit has to 4X just to stand still. So if you think about that, you know, if the P is going to be a quarter, then the share price, the profit's got four times to justify that. Mm. That's not an easy task, even for Altium that's growing. Group profit last year at 48%, I want to say. So if they can do it for a couple of years, then the P will come down, all the share price will go up, but either way, you'll get a return. But when you've got a 4X profit just to stand still for a market average-ish PE, because this can't go, you know, trees don't grow to the sky, as they say. Altium can't grow forever. There's only a certain number of people who use this software. The market's only ever a certain size. Maybe there's some pricing power there. Maybe there's some adoption there. Maybe there's some market share steal there. That's got to max out somewhere. So I do like Altium at the current price, but as a whole, I wouldn't be buying the shares, but I wouldn't be rushing to sell them either. I think this is a business that has demonstrated its ability to get sales and profit growth. And yes, the PE is high, but thus far, it's doing everything it can to justify that. I put it in the same broad league, not quite the same quality as the old CSL. So CSL's been expensive forever, right? It's been expensive for as long as you and I have been doing this. And it's always looked expensive, and, you know, it can't possibly keep growing at that rate, can it? And the answer was, yes, it can. Mm. It's made to make us look stupid because we kind of say, wait till the gradual gets cheaper, it never gets cheaper. I think Altium is probably in that league. So I think of the five we've talked about, it's got the longest history of profitability, longest history of success and actually being in business, as you mentioned before. Mm. So I think of the five, it's the one I feel best about its current valuation and the current share price, given the level of performance. And again, you want to be very careful and watch it for any sign that the top or bottom line are deteriorating. But if they're not, it's a pretty good buy for the risk-tolerant investor who's happy to just know that it could well double or halve just on sentiment alone, let alone the performance of the business.
Scott, I think we'll stop there. We've just covered so much ground.
You mean I've talked for too long?
No, it's so valuable for people to get a really deep understanding of each of these companies and your views on where they stand both as a company but also the valuations. So halfway through our waxes, we will break this here and we're going to come back next week so people can get the second half and find out everything else there is to know about this group.
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.